We not as a circuit in this regard?
No, I don't believe we do. I think that the circuits are evenly split on that. There is
Which circuit would you say speaks favorably of Bell?
Well, I believe the Fourth Circuit, and we cited this in the brief, Trujillo, which I believe is the Tenth Circuit. And the difference among the circuits is extremely subtle, because I believe other circuits who have declined to follow Bell indicate that the misconduct has to be aimed directly at the parent-child relation. That hasn't been the holding here in this circuit for 20 years, and there's been at least three cases in the last 3 or 4 years, and I think the various members of the panel here have sat on those cases in which they implicitly or explicitly reaffirm the vitality of Bell. Estate of Moreland, that just came down in January of 2005.
This issue wasn't raised in that case.
You're correct, Judge Sykes. That was not raised, but that was an action brought under the 14th Amendment. And so that's why I'm saying it was implicitly reaffirmed. Same thing with Muhammad versus City of Chicago. And then the third case is Graham versus Village of or Sauk Village. Those are three cases within the past 10 years in which this court recognized that there might be a claim for wrongful death, and the term used is a correlative right to a Section 1983 action based upon the 14th Amendment. Secondly, if in this case, Judge Flom, you don't have to reach the issue of whether or not you should revisit Bell. That's going to be a matter that would have to be decided en banc. And certainly this court doesn't need to get to that point to make a decision on whether or not the lower court correctly applied the principles of Bell. At the very least, in this case, it should be up to a jury to decide whether or not Mr. Russ had become part of another family unit. And that is assuming that the trial court is correct in its conclusion that someone that becomes a part of another family unit, that terminates a parent's 14th Amendment right to the society of their child or their children.
When would it not be subject to summary judgment, Mr. Tuohy? I'm trying to think of the principle one would apply. For example, if one were married 2 years and were separated, I mean, you can see the various scenarios that play out, or divorced or whatever. What should it always be a jury question, I guess, it's never going to be subject to a summary judgment.
I would agree with that. And the reason I say that is the trial court incorrectly is focusing on the fact that Mr. Russ may have by fortuity impregnated Aaron Lewis. He didn't know whether that was his child.
We know that by what? His prior statements he had made prior to his death?
He didn't know that. He told his mother
that
he didn't know that. And that, of course,
that's from the deposition of the mother.
Correct. Right. All of which, it's all hearsay.
No, I understand.
But we didn't know that until 3 months later, and then the Circuit Court of Cook County ordered a DNA test, and that's when it was determined it was his child. But the example that I would give you is this. Let's say, for instance, that Mr. Russ was married and had two children on the date of his death in June of 99. But he had impregnated Aaron Lewis, who was going to have his child. How many family units is he a member of?
So that's a jury question.
Exactly. Okay. But even it's not something that can be resolved as a matter of law on summary judgment. And the reason being, and this is the actual language that this court used in Bell versus City of Milwaukee, in which they identified the fact that Mr. Bell's son, Daniel, was 23 years old, living alone, and made the statement to the, or in its decision, that the decedent, Mr. Bell's son, his age and separate residence were matters for the jury to consider when determining damages. These were not a bar to any recovery at all. And so what this court has said and reaffirmed explicitly or implicitly is that in these kinds of cases, the only difference between age and whether he's living under another roof has to do with the closeness of the relationship. That's a matter of damages. In the same fashion that maybe a 6-year-old child would have a much closer relationship with his mother than a 56-year-old child. But again, that doesn't have anything to do with the nature of the parent-child relationship. It has to do with the strength of it, and that's measured by a jury in damages. There's nothing in Bell which indicates that that is a bar, and I believe that that is a basis for reversal, the fact that there's a misapplication of that longstanding precedent in this circuit, as well as Graham, Estate of Moreland, and Muhammad. Those are versus City. Those are the most recent cases, and I think that they're all in accord.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Tuohy. Ms. Pastor.
May it please the Court. The plaintiff's lawsuit is premised on the cause of action first recognized in the Bell v. City of Milwaukee decision. Since Bell was decided, however, by the city's count, at least 7 circuits, including the 4th Circuit in the Shaw v. Stroud decision, and the 10th Circuit in Trujillo, and again, more recently, in the Archuleta decision, and 1 state Supreme Court have specifically rejected that cause of action. Today, we urge this court to do the same. This morning, I will explain first why the Bell decision is inconsistent with contemporary 4th Amendment jurisprudence, and second, why Bell is inconsistent with contemporary 14th Amendment jurisprudence as well. At the time Bell was decided, it was not clear whether excessive force claims brought by a free citizen were to be analyzed under the 4th or the 14th Amendment. Since Bell was decided, however, the Supreme Court has told us 3 things about excessive force claims that are important here. 1. Excessive force claims must be analyzed according to the 4th Amendment's reasonableness standards. 2nd, and this goes back to even before Bell, 4th Amendment rights are personal to the victim of the alleged violation. They do not extend to all those who may be adversely affected by an illegal search or seizure. Finally, the Supreme Court has told us that in areas that are judged according to 4th Amendment standards, the more generalized notion of substantive due process has no role to play. In this case, Russ's parents were not the victims of any excessive force. Russ was. Not only can Russ's parents not assert a claim for a violation of Russ's 4th Amendment rights, they should not be permitted to use the 14th Amendment's due process clause as a way of circumventing the 4th Amendment's limits on who can sue for an illegal search or seizure.
Does it make any difference whether there's an estate bringing the suit as opposed to the individual?
Well, the estate can assert a 4th Amendment claim. The estate, in this instance, chose to sue in state court and did not bring a 4th Amendment
claim.
Does
that preclude this suit?
That alone doesn't preclude this suit, Your Honor. Why?
If it's personal.
Well, if the estate, which in this case the special administrator of the state was Ms. Lewis, had never chosen to bring any claim at all, we would still be here arguing that the parents can't assert the claim that they're asserting today. Not only can Russ's parents not sue, for the 4th Amendment rights, they shouldn't be permitted to use the 14th Amendment as a way of circumventing it. This is particularly true because the Due Process Clause's protections simply do not reach this kind of claim. The Bell decision was a departure from the Supreme Court's case law on the right to associate with one's child. No Supreme Court case has ever concluded that the Due Process Clause covers official actions that were not directly aimed at interfering with the parent-child relationship. In an excessive force case, such as this one, the officer's intent is to apprehend a suspect, not to interfere with anyone's family relationships. Any effect on the suspect's family members is therefore incidental. Based on this, numerous circuits have refused to extend the Due Process Clause's protections to parents and family members of a victim of excessive force. This lack of governmental action targeted at the parent-child relationship is significant for at least 2 reasons. First, It means that the official was not acting deliberately, at least vis-a-vis the family member. And Section 1983 is generally only intentional government actions may generally be the subject of a Section 1983 suit. The second reason why this is important is that one of the goals of Section 1983 is, of course, deterrence. But permitting family members to bring this kind of claim can serve no deterrent effect because the officer does not know at the time of the arrest whether the suspect has a family member who might sue. There's simply no reason to impose additional constitutional liability on a police officer simply because the person he's trying to arrest happens to have a family. Now, Mr. Tuohy has stated this morning, in response to your question, Judge Flom, that the court need not reach the question of Bell's continuing validity. That's only true if Mr. Tuohy wants to lose the case. If this court wishes to reverse the district court, it has to therefore explicitly reaffirm the cause of action recognized in Bell. And there's certainly no reason to hold a trial without deciding this legal issue first. In conclusion, there's one point on which we agree with Bell. Even Bell recognized that the law of torts, including the law of constitutional torts, must impose some limitations on who can sue for any given tort. Bell itself rejected the claims of the siblings as having gone a step too far. The problem with Bell, however, is that by including the parents of the victim of excessive force in the class of people who may sue for that violation, it draws a line in a place that's inconsistent with substantive Fourth Amendment and 14th Amendment standards. The Fourth Amendment grants no rights to parents of a victim of an illegal search or seizure. Otherwise, parents could sue every time a child is wrongfully arrested, and we in fact know that that's not the case.
Counsel, if I could clarify your argument. Yeah. You're arguing for a rule that would preclude a cause of action for adult children, for the parental relationship with adult children, or are you arguing for a rule that precludes a cause of action for interference with the parental right in all excessive force cases, whether the victim is an adult child or a minor child?
Well, Your Honor, of course, the issue of a minor child is not presented, and it's only arisen in the context
of the adult child. But you are making
this
broader argument that these cases have to be analyzed exclusively under the Fourth Amendment. That's why my question.
Yes, Your Honor. That would be our position, that the principles would apply equally to adult or minor children. There is clearly a difference between the parental liberty interest between parents and minor children and parents and adult children. But for the principles of the Fourth Amendment, it appears to be the same. The Due Process Clause also grants no rights to parents with respect to police actions that are not directly aimed at this parent-child relationship, or else, again, a parent could sue every time a child is wrongfully imprisoned. The right place to draw the line is with respect to the scope of the substantive rights at stake. And here that line does not include parents. If there are no further questions, the city asks that the judgment of the district court be affirmed.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Pastor. Mr. Castiglione?
Your Honor, good morning. May it please the court. I'm Paul Castiglione, and I represent Deputy Sheriff Robert Helson, the defendant in this matter. Your Honor, plaintiffs have also filed a due process claim against Deputy Sheriff Helson, alleging that he failed to intervene to prevent Officer Watts, one of the other defendants, from using excessive force against Robert Russ. As an initial matter, Deputy Sheriff Helson joins the city's arguments on Bell versus City of Milwaukee, asking for that the case be overruled. And we also join their arguments that plaintiffs lack standing to bring their due process claim. The district court's decision granting Helson's motion for summary judgment can also be affirmed on the alternative basis that, based on the record below, plaintiffs cannot establish a failure to intervene claim against Helson. Under this court's decision in Yang versus Hardin, plaintiff would have to show that Helson knew excessive force was being used against Robert Russ, that Helson knew that a constitutional violation was being committed, and importantly, that Helson had a realistic opportunity to intervene to prevent the harm that was occurring. Based on a record below, plaintiff cannot meet these elements. After a high-speed chase going over three expressways, all three officers, the individual officers in this case, directed Mr. Russ, after his car had stopped, to leave his vehicle and to show his hands. Mr. Russ did not do so. Helson, as plaintiffs have admitted, was crouched on the passenger side of Mr. Russ's car, where it stopped. Helson spoke calmly to Russ and attempted to convince him to leave his car and surrender. Officer Watts was standing on the driver's side of Russ's car, a foot or two away from the car. Officer Watts eventually broke the back window on the driver's side of the car. Because of Mr. Russ's large physical size, Mr. Officer Helson could not see on the other side of a car to see what was happening. After the window was broken, at one point, Russ suddenly and quickly reached over his left shoulder with his right hand toward Officer Watts. Within a couple seconds, Watts's gun fired. The discharge of a gun was sudden, and only one shot was fired. As Helson was speaking with Russ and asking him to surrender, he could not have known that Russ would lunge at Watts and that Watts's gun would discharge. Helson had no reasonable opportunity to prevent any harm from occurring. In their reply brief, plaintiffs have suggested that this case is analogous to the case Yang versus Hardin. We strongly disagree with that. In Yang, the defendant police officers attempted to shoplift from a burglarized store owner. One officer struck the plaintiff and then drove away, literally dragging the plaintiff from the side of a squad car. The other officer did nothing and, in fact, actually pulled a weapon on the plaintiff. That's very different in this case. Officer Helson, and the undisputed record shows, was trying to help Mr. Russ. The shot happened suddenly. He had no reasonable opportunity to prevent harm from occurring. If anything, this case is comparable to the case of Lanigan versus Village of East Hazelcrest, which we cited. For those reasons, Judge, if Your Honors, I have no further questions. We'd ask that the decision below be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Castellano. Mr. Toohey.
With respect to the suggestion that this court reject Bell, the reason I'm saying that you don't need to reach that is if, as this court should do, based upon the errors committed by the lower court in granting summary judgment, remands this case to the lower court, there are a number of issues that can resolve this case short of revisiting Bell. And certainly you don't need to look at that if the case can be taken care of on other grounds, particularly if there are remaining factual issues that may never even reach the question on whether or not Bell should be revisited. Judge Caney, I think you asked the question whether that there is a difference between an estate with a cause of action, which would be personal under the Fourth Amendment, and Mr. Russ and Mrs. Love, Robert's parents. And there is. I think that the holdings of this circuit and Bell and their progeny indicate or reflect the fact that the 14th Amendment should be uniform in this circuit, so that when you're dealing with wrongful death statutes in Indiana or Illinois or Wisconsin, those are aimed at compensation and pecuniary loss. Those are not aimed at the two points that Bell is, which is deterrence and the application of damages for loss of life, which wrongful death statutes do not address. So this is a personal action under the 14th Amendment by the parents. And those are the two main differences. One is constitutional, the other one is state statute, and that was recognized by this court in Bell. And then that's the reason that there is a divergence, because tomorrow any of the state legislatures could repeal the Wrongful Death Act, could put additional restrictions on it. As in Bell, they put it, there was a limit of $18,000 in damages. And that's the reason that this court in the last 20 years has said, in instances of constitutional misconduct, we're not going to look at the state Wrongful Death Act if it's inconsistent with those objectives of federal policy.
Mr. Toohey, would you extend this to, let's say, someone raised by a guardian, not a parent?
I would say no, not under the holding of Bell. I think this court was clear on that when they said it's a difficult decision on how far we're going to extend the umbrella of Bell. It's difficult to draw the line, but draw it we must. I think that was the language that they used, and they drew it at the parent-child relationship. And that is really what the core was of Bell, is the parent-child relationship, which is invoked here. When the city defendant is asking to revisit Bell, they have to provide a compelling reason to do so, and they haven't done that, other than they just think that they like the rule from other circuits that they've followed better than the rule that we followed for 20 years.
That's usually the reason we're asked to revisit, though.
And if we are going to do that, then we have to do that en banc. Did I interrupt you, Judge?
I was merely going to make the same point. I mean, if Bell was wrongly decided and has not stood the test of time and we're out of step with the rest of the country, then doesn't that provide the compelling reason to revisit it?
It might be. It might, but I don't think that they've established a compelling reason other than the fact that other circuits may have a little different bend on it. And it all has to do with whether the misconduct is intentionally aimed at the disruption of the parent-child relationship or whether it's incidental. So if you have a police officer who goes in and takes a child out of the home, that's an actionable disruption in other circuits. If he goes in there and uses excessive force to kill the child, well, then that's not actionable. And that's a subtle difference. But that's not something that I think that we need to look at, because I think we've cited cases in our brief, and I won't belabor the point, that the fact that other circuits may have taken a different twist on that is not a compelling reason. And other than that, they haven't provided any. And unless there's any other questions, I'll rest on our briefs.
All right, thank you, Mr. Toohey. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will proceed to the second case of the